Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last month, the state of South Carolina carried out its first execution in 13 years. Freddie Owens had been sentenced to death in 1999 for the 1997 murder of Irene Graves, a convenience store clerk. It happened during a robbery. Owens died by lethal injection on September 20th. But the Palmetto State houses five more death row inmates who are expected to be executed in the next 6 months, each to be given the choice of dying by lethal injection, the electric chair, or by firing squad. Capital punishment has been used since the very beginnings of civilization, usually for the most heinous of crimes, but it has become controversial in recent years with various organizations, individuals, and religious groups holding different views on the ethical nature of the death penalty. Some are concerned about just how humane it really is. Others question the right of the state to take a life. And in recent years, with the dawn of DNA evidence, new concerns have risen about executing potentially innocent people for whom that evidence may not exist. In the short time that DNA has been available, more than 159 inmates sitting on death rows have been exonerated. Today, we look at this nation's use of capital punishment, when and how often it is used, whether it is, in fact, a deterrent to crime, and more. Elizabeth Brunick has written extensively about this. She was a finalist for the 2023 Pulitzer Prize for her reporting on a series of botched executions by the Alabama Department of Corrections, and she is a staff writer for The Atlantic. Jeffrey Collins is a reporter for the Associated Press covering South Carolina. He witnessed the execution of Freddie Owens. And Gretchen Engel is a capital defense attorney and executive director of the Center for Death Penalty Litigation in Durham, a North Carolina nonprofit law firm representing people facing the death penalty and other extreme sentences. Thank you all three for being here. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
Good morning. So, Jeffrey, I'm going to begin with you because you witnessed the recent execution of Freddie Owens in South Carolina. Just to recap, he was convicted of committing an armed robbery, I believe at the age of 19. If I'm correct about this, while he was on trial, he killed his cellmate in the Greenville County Detention Center. That sounds like an open and shut case, but evidently, evidence brought out by his attorney at his final appeal cast a shadow over his conviction. What can you tell us about that?
In the weeks before the execution, Freddie Owens' lawyers, they got an affidavit, a sworn statement from the co-defendant in the case, the other person who was in the store with Freddie Owens and testified that Owens pulled the trigger, to say that no, that Owens wasn't in the store with him. The co-defendant wouldn't say who pulled the trigger, but did say that Owens wasn't there. And so the final appeal was that there needed to be a pause in the execution so a court could look over what this new evidence was. Both the South Carolina Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court decided that that pause didn't need to take place.
Did that contradict his testimony during the trial, the fact that he wasn't there, that this co-defendant said he wasn't there?
Yes, and the co-defendant was a fairly significant portion of the co-defendant's testimony was a fairly significant portion of the state's case. There wasn't any scientific evidence that linked Freddie Owens to this. There was a video in the store, but they're wearing masks and it was hard to identify who pulled the trigger. Although prosecutors later said, well, they were both wearing different kind of masks. And so they tried to link Freddie Owens to a stocking mask instead of a ski mask. So there was some stuff like that, but there wasn't the scientific evidence that you might've seen if this was a case that was brought 20, 25 years later.
And again, this crime was committed in 1997 and video surveillance cameras back then were not what they are today. They were their standard definition and they were often very difficult to really get any detail. His attorney, Mr. Owens' attorney, also alleged that Owens had brain damage from a prior conviction. Is that accurate? And did that come into play at all?
That was also argued, although that was more of a that was a lesser point of the appeal. And I mean, it wasn't anything that even like the judges latched onto. The biggest part of Owens's final last ditch appeal was that he wasn't was his co-defendant saying he wasn't there in the first place.
So, Elizabeth, you have written extensively about this across the country. You've done a lot of deep dive research into this. How often are there complications like the ones that we're talking about with Freddie Owens in these death penalty cases?
I think you see this kind of issue repeatedly in death penalty cases. I think recently the Equal Justice Institute published a statistic that for every eight people executed, one on death row is exonerated. And you know that's a pretty amazing number, and it is a testament to how frequently innocence issues come up or other issues in litigation. With regards to individuals having fair trials and so
From
forth,
what you've learned in your research, are these claims of innocence taken seriously or are they regarded cavalierly?
I think it's very difficult to mount an innocence claim that gains traction. But you know, periodically you do see cases that arouse a lot of public offense, right? I mean, the Marcellus Williams case was a recent one where the innocence claim was particularly strong, and it gathered a lot of momentum publicly. But in the end, the courts were insensitive to that claim, and Marcellus was executed.
Gretchen Engel is with us. She's a capital defense attorney. In the case we've been talking about with Freddie Owens, we have this instance of late-breaking evidence in this final appeal. We have allegations of legal errors in the previous trials, hidden deals, and according to his attorney, false evidence. And yet this appeal was denied, and South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster refused to grant clemency. In most of these cases, in these death penalty cases, does the state usually side against the defendant?
Oh, almost uniformly, they do. It's very rare that the state would come out in support of particularly a late-breaking innocence claim. And I think I went to bed thinking Marcellus Williams was going to get clemency, and of course was very disappointed to see that. And just to amplify on what Elizabeth was saying, you know, we've executed 44 people under our modern capital punishment statute in North Carolina. And during that time, there have been 12 exonerations. And so if you look at the ratio of 12 to 44, that's even more troubling than the 1 in 8 statistic reported.
Jeffrey, in the Freddie Owens case in South Carolina, the state Supreme Court there unanimously tossed out two requests from defense lawyers alleging new information about a secret deal that had kept the co-defendant off death row, among other things. The court ruled that the evidence did not reach the, quote, exceptional circumstances needed to allow another appeal. Did they explain that ruling further?
They did not go into a lot of detail, but oftentimes it's not an unusual thing from the South Carolina Supreme Court. A couple of, there's once a trial is finished, a lot of things get locked into place. The original trial in a death penalty case, a lot of things get locked into place. And so at that point, the system is designed to where, a defendant has to come up with a very extraordinary reason to be able to reopen a case, to be able to make these kind of last-ditch appeals. And it's just the way that the system is designed. I mean, it puts people in a position where, again, if you don't have a good lawyer at your trial, who's making objections and bringing up, bringing in whatever evidence they possibly can, things get very locked in the appeals process. It's very hard to shake a case loose after that trial is finished.
Gretchen, these death row appeals can go on for years, decades in some cases. It would seem, from a 30,000-foot view, from a citizen who isn't involved in this at all, that the state is giving defendants multiple avenues to explore their innocence or to appeal and walk away from a death sentence. before the final moment. It appears that way. From your experience, is that the case?
No, it is not. And it's certainly true that people spend a long time on death row. Most of the time, curiously, I think, particularly for the broader public, those cases are largely inactive. I mean, there's a set number of stages of appeal, and as Jeffrey was suggesting, there are all these procedural technical rules that really narrow as you go along the path closer to the death chamber, the avenues for you to actually obtain relief get narrower and narrower. Sometimes these appeals have been referred to as having traps for the unwary. And in, for example, in North Carolina, where three quarters of our row was sentenced in the 1990s, people were represented by people who didn't have jury trial experience, largely concentrated on real estate law, but happened to be friendly with the local judge who appointed them, a recently disgraced and let out of prison former assistant prosecutor who had been convicted of receiving child pornography through the U.S. mail. I mean, these are the kinds of people that were representing people in the most serious crimes.
Elizabeth, as you've looked at this across the country in the articles that you've written for The Atlantic, are you finding a similar story in all these different state courts?
Yeah, absolutely. Repeatedly in my reporting, I've seen just complete, ineffectiveness of counsel. People who, you know, as Gretchen was saying, shouldn't really be serving as a defense in these trials. I've seen claims, especially of intellectual disability, that should have been pressed in the trial that instead wind up introduced in the appeals process when it's really difficult to apply that information usefully.
I want to ask why, but I want to give Jeffrey a chance to come in here for a second.
I was just going to mention in Freddie Owens's case there was a public defender who had a ton of cases that they were dealing with in the original trial, and then he had a pro bono attorney, private attorney, happens to be a state senator right now. But I mean, you know, it just was, you know, it was a very short trial. I mean, we think about death penalty trials lasting weeks. In Freddie Owens's case, it was done, both the guilt phase and the sentencing phase lasted less than a week. The good thing in South Carolina now is we have a group of lawyers that only specialize in death penalty cases or very heinous, serious crimes that could face the death penalty. So these inmates, these defendants now get lawyers that are well trained. South Carolina's death row, when they had their last execution in 2011 before they restarted, had 62, 63 people on it. Right now, there's 32, and they only had one execution. The reason why is a lot of these, you know, more than almost half death row got let out on appeals for the most part. There's been a couple of natural deaths. But so, I mean, it's just process of now the cases are taken much more seriously. You get a much more competent group of attorneys, and it's reduced the number, at least in South Carolina, of the death row in half.
I have 30 seconds left, Gretchen. If the justice system is looking for justice, why do we handle the most serious of these cases in which the sentence is final so cavalierly?
I think there's a lot of emotion around these crimes. A lot of the rules that we made governing them were created in the 1990s when the fear of crime was at its zenith. And we haven't talked about racism yet. That has a role in it as well.
We will talk about racism. We're also going to talk about the various different methods that states use to put people to death who have been convicted of a crime that warrants the death penalty, in their opinion, and whether crimes do in fact warrant the death penalty. We'll come back and talk about that and more in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE in Hickory. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the death penalty, how we exercise it in this country, in these two states, North and South Carolina. and more with Jeffrey Collins, who is a reporter for the Associated Press covering South Carolina. He was in attendance at the execution recently of Freddie Owens in that state. Gretchen Engel is a capital defense attorney and the executive director of the Center for Death Penalty Litigation in Durham. And Elizabeth Brunig is a staff writer for The Atlantic, who has written extensively on death penalty cases around the country. Freddie Owens' co-defendant, Jeffrey, in this trial, was given life in prison, if I'm not mistaken. He claims that Owens was not at the murder scene that day, at least in the latest appeal. Is there no evidence to prove that he was at that location at that time?
Actually, Mike, in the end, he got 30 years. The deal was okay. There would be no... There was a lot of dispute about the deal. Prosecutor said we didn't offer him anything in exchange for his testimony, just that we'd say, you know, that he helped us out. But then in the end, instead of there being a death penalty case against him or a life sentence, he ended up getting 30 years. Again, all the evidence there is, like I said, there's a convenience store camera video, but they're both wearing masks and it's very poor quality. Right. There is testimony from the co-defendant that Freddie Owens was there. And Freddie Owens did tell a couple other people that he was there that did also testify or tell police that he was there. But if you're talking about actual physical evidence that he was there, there's none of that.
Yeah, let's talk about that, Gretchen, because in this case, the video evidence doesn't show clearly who the shooter was. The criminal justice officials evidently never found the weapon used in the shooting, and no scientific evidence was presented during the trial conclusively linking Owens to the murder. When there is a question about whether you were the one who actually pulled the trigger in these instances, is capital punishment usually applied as a sentence? I mean, is it just enough to be in the room when the murder happens?
Well, I think yes is the answer to that question. And one of the things I think that often people think about the death penalty is, oh, it's reserved for the worst of the worst. It is for really cold, calculated, very well planned out murders. And people do not realize, for example, that if you are part of a group that goes into rob a grocery store, for example, you don't have a weapon. Maybe you're out in the car, you're the getaway driver, and you know, under the state's theory of the case, you can also get the death penalty under the felony murder rule.
In a situation like this where there is little tangible evidence, they didn't find the murder weapon, they can't connect it to the guy who pulled the trigger, there's no fingerprint information, there's no video information showing faces. It seems
this
extreme
is just
to me.
So common, though. Common. This is not, and there's so much emphasis, I think, in our system of, well, if the jury believed it. And yet we know that often jurors come in thinking, well, the prosecution wouldn't be prosecuting if they didn't have something, if they didn't know that he was the right guy, why would he be on trial? I think a lot of those attitudes, and when you don't have good lawyers selecting the jury, you can have a lot of biases in the jury room, racial biases in addition to just pro-conviction and fear of crime kinds of biases that allow people who you look at the quality of the evidence and think, how could this be? But it happens over and over.
Elizabeth, in the series that you wrote that became a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, you devoted an article to the execution of Joan Nathan James Jr. in Alabama in 2022. The victim was Faith Hall, and her family pleaded for mercy for James, and yet the state acted against their wishes. Why was the victim's family asking that his life be spared?
For reasons that, again, aren't that uncommon. They felt that their mother, it was two of her daughters and her brother who were protesting the execution. They felt that their mother, their sister, wouldn't have wanted the execution, that she was a forgiving person. And that she wouldn't have wanted that carried out. My own family, my sister-in-law was murdered in 2016 in Texas. And so, you know, we had the opportunity to ask the prosecution to seek the death penalty. And again, my family just decided that she wouldn't have wanted it. In the case of James Barber, who was executed in Alabama, the victim's family protested his execution, and would have preferred he not be executed. I know of a case in Texas, Erica Shepherd, where the victim's family advocated against her execution, many years after she was sentenced. But again, I don't think it's uncommon for victims' families to decide they're not interested in executions, even after the person has been sentenced. I think victims' families have a lot of impact on the cases when they are in favor of execution, but I don't think victims' families have a lot of impact on these cases when they're against the execution. The state typically doesn't regard those wishes the way they regard the wishes for capital punishment.
With regard to lethal injection, there are serious concerns about the humaneness of that as a method of execution, concerns over whether they result actually in excruciating silent pain on the part of the person being executed. And that led, those concerns led, I believe, to manufacturers of the pharmaceuticals used in that process to withhold those drugs from the states so they couldn't use them. They couldn't do death by lethal injection, and it stopped the process for a while. And yet, South Carolina passed a law shielding manufacturers. So they have resumed using lethal injection. The story of Joe Nathan James Jr.'s execution illustrates one of these many concerns over this process. You say, Elizabeth, that visual evidence from a private autopsy showed highly unusual treatment of the inmate prior to the injection, something that was contradicted by the official report from the Alabama Department of Corrections. You were there for the autopsy. What did you witness?
There had already been one autopsy because the state performs an autopsy, I'm pretty sure mandatorily, on people who are executed in Alabama. So his body had been in cool storage for a few days when the second private autopsy took place. The private autopsy took place because, again, we couldn't be sure that the state was going to be completely honest in their report. You know, it just seemed unlikely because the state had already been dishonest about what happened to James. I say he was in cool storage because it wouldn't have been possible at that point to count all the puncture marks in his skin. But the ones we did find were in his arms, hands, and foot. And on his inner elbow, there were slices in his skin made by a sharp instrument. And it appeared they were attempting what is called a venous cut down, where the skin over the vein is open to expose the vein. That is obviously not part of Alabama's protocol. It should have caused a review of their procedures and processes right then when it happened, but it didn't.
Would he have been anesthetized before they performed those procedures on him, or is there any way to tell whether he was or was not?
The protocol required 2 vials of midazolam, which is an anticonvulsant drug that results in sedation. We don't know if he was sedated using that midazolam before this cut down was attempted. One pathologist from the Mayo Clinic did tell me the position and the number of slices in his skin indicated that he was probably thrashing on the gurney.
From the pain of the injection, or them trying to find a vein, or for some other reason?
For them trying to find a vein cutting into his skin. It appears he was thrashing at that point.
It sounds horrific, no question about it. I wouldn't want to be in that position, but I have to ask a devil's advocate question here for a moment, Gretchen. The inmate in this case was a murderer. He didn't seem to care about the pain or suffering of his victim or the victim's family. So let me ask a question from listeners who don't agree with any of what we're talking about here. Why should society care about the cruelty or the pain involved in the final punishment?
Well, I think it says a lot about who we are as a society and who we want to be as a people. Brian Stevenson, who many of you know, the head of the Equal Justice Initiative and the creator of the Legacy Museum in Montgomery, says, you know, this is not about does this person who may have committed a horrific, horrific crime, does that person deserve to live? It's, do we have the right to kill them? And I think there's so many things when you look at the broader system, you know, when you think of these cases, as you mentioned earlier, going on so long, what is it we're actually giving to victims of crime? And before I stop, I want to acknowledge, I'm so sorry to hear about your sister-in-law, Elizabeth, yeah. And to know that you're so immersed in this work, it's really unimaginable for me.
Oh, but, Gretchen, yeah. You're the attorney on this panel, and Elizabeth mentioned that the state of Alabama has protocols, as all states do, for these mm-hmm. executions, whether they do it by lethal injection or the electric chair or some other way. But are there laws surrounding how these procedures are executed? I mean, if the state violates its protocol, can they be sued?
Theoretically, the issue is how do you find out about it and how do you prove it? North Carolina hasn't had an execution since 2006. And prior to that, there was a lot of litigation about lethal injection. And so at some point, the Department of Correction, under false pretenses, obtained this thing called the BIS monitor, which they claimed a doctor would be looking at and would be monitoring during the execution. We found, and they told a federal judge that that was what was going to happen. And so the stay was lifted, the execution went forward. And what we learned later was that the doctor was not even in the room, was not looking at the monitor. But there's nothing to be done about it afterwards. And so these things are done. You know, there's a reason we do these killings at 2 a.m. There is some shame, I think, involved that we know that this is not, it's not who we want to be, but right. Yet it is who we are.
Well, you bring up 2 a.m. because nobody's up and it kind of hides the fact that we've done it. You wake up in the morning and you read in the paper, or you hear on the radio or on television that it was done. In her story, Jeffrey, Elizabeth points out that lethal injections, at least the insertion of the needle, happens behind the curtain usually or in another room. And then the curtain opens and the execution takes place. Perhaps the person has a final word or two. It looks all very surgical, very planned out. You were there at the execution of Freddie Owens. Is that how it was? Is it painless in your mind from what you witnessed?
Yes, from what I witnessed, but there's that impossibility of it, right? I mean, like, how do we detect pain? I mean, there's really no medical way to detect it. I mean, is it because someone looks uncomfortable or grimacing? I mean, that could be an indication. But ultimately, the best way to determine it is to ask the person if they felt pain, and the prisoner's dead. You can't ask them that. So, right. And in South Carolina, you know, the needle was inserted before, you know, the IV's put in before the curtain opens. There's two key ways a lethal injection goes wrong. Either the drugs aren't right or the IV is inserted wrong. And so under South Carolina Shield law, we don't see the IV go in and we don't know the composition of the drugs. So at this point, it's a total trust game on the part of the state. And I mean, also in South Carolina, the Shield law, y'all were talking about protocols. South Carolina Shield law, we don't know the amount of drug that's given. We don't know the people involved. Their names are kept secret. We don't know the exact sequence of events that happened because it's all kept secret under the Shield law.
And Elizabeth, you go into some very gruesome details. You've alluded to some of them on the air. We don't need to be more graphic than that. But in your article, it gets really, really gruesome in terms of what happened to Joe Nathan James. From what you know about lethal injections and how they're carried out around the country, this took place in Oklahoma. Is this happening regularly? Is this a rare instance of this happening?
No, botches with lethal injection are very common, more common than people know. There are a lot of reasons for that. I think one of the reasons that seems most compelling to me is that, you know, the states have a very hard time getting medical personnel involved with executions. Nurses and doctors, I think in some states, could potentially lose their license for participating in an execution. So I think it's very hard to recruit these people because, A, that's not why people go into the healthcare industry. It's not because they want to kill people. And B, nobody who is doing healthcare services wants to be known as an executioner. That's not what you go to a doctor for, is someone who kills. So I think that is a big reason that they have difficulty setting these IV lines over and over again. It's not uncommon at all.
In one of her articles, Gretchen Elizabeth quotes Deborah Denno, a law professor and founding director of the Neuroscience and Law Center at Fordham Law School. And she says, from the very first lethal injection execution to the last, the method is predictably disastrous. I'll ask you if you agree with that, but the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution says it bans cruel and unusual punishment. Is this cruel and unusual punishment in your mind?
I believe so. We have litigated lethal injection in our state for many years. One of the things actually we litigated related to what Elizabeth was just bringing up was the medical association issued an ethical rule saying it would be unethical and that a physician could be subject to discipline for participating in a execution. And the Court of Appeals declared that unenforceable and said, to the extent that capital punishment is the law, it's legal. The medical board, which is a state agency, is not permitted to discipline doctors. And yet we know, as you know, we have reports of executions in which people were, if not thrashing, certainly moving around, gasping in ways that people were troubled by, witnesses to these executions in North Carolina. So yes, it is barbaric. And it's experimental. I mean, we're experimenting now that we're trying these new methods in Alabama, you know, things that the Nazis did, right? I mean, this is really going into uncharted territory, trying things because we can't get the old drugs we used to use.
I want to come back and talk about that because I think many people are unaware of these experiments being conducted in lieu of these drugs. We'll do that when we come back and look at other methods of execution as well at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the death penalty because on September 20th, the state of South Carolina executed Freddie Owens. And there are five more people on death row in that state scheduled to be executed within the next 6 months. Jeffrey Collins has been a witness to this. He was a witness at Freddie Owens' execution in South Carolina. He covers the state for the Associated Press. Gretchen Engel is a capital defense attorney with the Center for Death Penalty Litigation. And Elizabeth Brennig is a staff writer for The Atlantic who has written extensively about this, about the executions. Just before the break, Gretchen, you were talking about these experiments being used on inmates as we execute them because we don't have access, in some cases, to the proper drugs. And you compared it to what the Nazis were doing when they were experimenting on people in the death camps. Tell us more about that. What are you talking about here?
Well, it's just, you know, we do know how to use medication to put someone to sleep, right? We do that with animals, and it's a compassionate thing that we do. This is obviously a very different thing. We've worked out these different drug protocols, and then at some point, pharmaceutical companies, many of them European-based, said, we don't want to sell these drugs to people. And so since then, there's just been well, maybe we can try these compounding pharmacies, or maybe we can try these other kind of drugs that haven't been used before, or maybe will we use nitrogen gas? Coming up with these novel ways to kill people, but still trying to do it in this sanitized.
But why? If we have methods that we use on animals, pets, that we have a loving relationship with, and we know how to do that successfully and painlessly, if we know that there are states where assisted suicide is legal and it's painless, why don't we just do it that way? Is there some vengeance being applied here?
It seems to me that that's part of what's going on, and that the population we're dealing with, that these are vulnerable people. These are, people who have, when we look at the life stories of people who are on death row, these are people who the system has failed. Either it hasn't helped them with mental illness, substance abuse, all these other things. And the idea that that crime happens because we don't deal with these root causes of societal problems. I think that's what the death penalty is about. It's kind of making us feel like, well, now we're doing something. Now we're really taking a stand when we could have done something else.
Elizabeth, as you looked around the country, are there standards? I mean, I know there are protocols, but are there standards for these executions? And is there any avenue of accountability when things go wrong?
There are protocols. There are, certain rules and functions that are supposed to take place on behalf of the state for carrying out these executions. They're supposed to be very uniform. I think the uniformity and attempts at precision in these procedures, which often fail, by the way, has to do with, disguising that what's going on is really kind of elemental and barbaric. These procedures in a lot of cases just give the facade of sort of a scientific approach, but that's not what's happening at all.
Jeffrey, the state of South Carolina offers death row inmates a choice. They can die by lethal injection, they can die in the electric chair, they can die by firing squad. Are there any figures on what these inmates most often choose?
It has been, South Carolina brought lethal injection into the mix about 30 years ago. And the overwhelming majority of the inmates choose lethal injection over the electric chair. The firing squad is a new development. One thing that they tried to, when they couldn't get the lethal injection drug that they put in place, trying to get around that problem and giving inmates a choice between firing squad and electrocution. In South Carolina, there's no firing squad yet because only one inmate's had the opportunity. And there's opportunity is a bad word. One inmate had the choice. And, electrocution, there's only been two of those since 2000 in South Carolina. There was one I covered about 2006. And then there was another inmate that chose the electric chair in roughly the same time frame.
And Elizabeth, you wrote this series for The Atlantic. And part of the series was an article called Can America Kill Its Prisoners Kindly, in which you traced the history of the death penalty, with the electric chair replacing hanging as a more humane means of execution until the very first use of the electric chair, which caused a major outcry because of what happened during that execution. Lethal injection became a method billed as being more humane than the electric chair. South Carolina offers the firing squad, as we just talked about. Are any of these methods more humane than another? Are they more humane than hanging or the guillotine or the gas chamber?
I think that we're dealing with different kinds of pain and injury. The psychological torture of the death penalty, I think, is uniform across methods. And so in that sense, the different methods are sort of immaterial because a lot of the suffering is taking place inside the person. I think there's an ongoing effort to come up with a more scientific, more painless, more humane method. I think that's part of what nitrogen hypoxia is about, is avoiding these issues with lethal injection that have been the subject of so many method challenges. But nitrogen hypoxia also appears to engender a lot of suffering. The people who have been killed by nitrogen hypoxia, Kenny Smith and Alan Miller, heaved and jerked on the gurney and gulped for air. I think that seems to be a pretty difficult death as well.
Gretchen, you said we haven't talked about race yet, so let's bring that into this. As of January 2024, if these figures are correct, about 941 inmates are on death rows around the country. 941 of the people on death rows around the country were white, 920 were black, 23 were Native Americans. Although there have been no federal executions since Donald Trump left office, 57 people sit on death row in federal cases. 34 of them are people of color, 26 are black men. Some were convicted by all-white juries. Further, more than 75% of death row defendants who have been executed were given that sentence as the result of killing white victims, even though in society as a whole, about half of the number of homicide victims are in fact African American. With that as background, North Carolina's Racial Justice Act allows people to challenge their death sentences if they can show that race played a role in their trials. But that act has been challenged in court. So has this act been used successfully, and where do challenges to that law stand?
Sure. So that law was enacted in 2009, and we have litigated it a long time. I won't go into all the ins and outs of it, but basically four people in 2020 were resentenced to life because they showed that race played a role in the selection of their juries. A couple of them were sentenced by all white juries, as you mentioned. Their cases boomeranged around back and forth, but ultimately they received life sentences. And in February of this year, another man in North Carolina had a 2-week evidentiary hearing about jury selection discrimination in his case, in his county, in the whole state, and also the issue of the fact that in his county, if you're black and go to a sentencing jury, you have a 100% chance of getting the death penalty. But if you're white, you have a 50-50 shot at getting a life sentence.
I was going to ask, certainly that during Jim Crow, there was probably very little question that if you were a black person, you were going to be tried by a white jury. And if it was a capital offense trial, you were going to get the death penalty. I was going to ask if things have improved, if the examples of that have diminished over time.
Sadly, they have not. The first person, if you look at our roster of people on death row in North Carolina, the person who's been there the longest, and back in 2010, when we were first litigating the Racial Justice Act, the person who had just gotten there, both had all white juries. Nearly half of the people on death row in North Carolina have had all white or only one person of color on their jury, which is shocking in a state that's 22-23% black.
Edward Chapman was on death row in this state for 13 years for the 1994 murder of two women in Hickory before he was exonerated in 2007. Since his release, he has asked three different North Carolina governors for an official pardon, which would entitle him to $50,000 for every year he spent in prison. He was in there, even though he was innocent, so I want to remind people of that. So far, those requests have all gone ignored. We had hoped to have Mr. Chapman on this program with us live today, but he didn't feel comfortable with that. So we had one of our producers, Gene Davis, speak with him, because today he is an advocate for the abolition of the death penalty. And he says the problem with capital punishment is that it will never be administered fairly.
You would never hear or see a police officer, a prosecutor, a judge, or a legislator, or any elected official sentenced to death. But they can do anything they want to do in office, while common people like ourselves, they would quickly burn us in a heartbeat.
Is he right about that, Gretchen?
Well, there's an old saw that says capital punishment is for those that don't have the capital. And certainly in our office, we represent indigent clients. These are people who do not have the funds to hire an attorney. The vast majority of people on death row are people who could not afford an attorney. And so, you know, I think he's not wrong.
And would it be accurate, Elizabeth, to say that, that a lot of these executions continue and the methods that we use continue because there is no lobby for people on Capitol, on death rows?
Right. I mean, I think at this point, 44% of people oppose capital punishment in the United States, which is, you know, one of the highest numbers on record for opposition. But I don't think it's a major issue for people who oppose the death penalty. And I don't think that they vote based on it. There's certainly no single issue voters who are only interested in the death penalty, except maybe me. I think there's no lobby for a lot of reasons. But for one, you know, these are difficult people to advocate for. And capital defense attorneys take a lot of guff for what they do in representing these folks. So I think the lobby is small but dedicated.
Getting back to Edward Chapman, who once again was on death row in this state for 13 years before being exonerated, he says he would like to see the death penalty done away with.
I'd like to see it be tossed out, erased from the book. Well, you can't erase the history of it, but do away with it. If you want to try something new, try reconnecting, rebuilding our relationships with the victims and these people. You know, give them the opportunity. Don't make the decision for them. You know, maybe they can offer them some type of relief.
More than 75 countries in the world have ended capital punishment. The five countries that have not ended it are China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the United States. I'm not sure who to ask this question of. Why have these other countries ended the practice? What have they replaced it with? And what has been the result of that? Anybody know?
Well, I think one of the easiest examples to look at is the United Kingdom, right? Because they're comparable development and they're an Anglophone country, just like the US. They abolished their death penalty in the 60s, I believe. And an interesting thing happened after abolition, which is support for the death penalty began to fall after it was banned. So there was a certain level of support for the death penalty. And then over time, as it was an unavailable punishment, support for it actually declined. So I think it's possible to imagine eradicating the death penalty, abolishing the death penalty, and finding that people come to value that kind of humanity in government over time.
The state carries out executions on behalf of the citizens of the state, whether it's the state of South Carolina or North Carolina or the country at large, although federal executions have not taken place in a while. Jeffrey, is there any indication of how people of the state of South Carolina, given that five more inmates are on death row scheduled to be executed in the next 6 months, how they feel about this?
You know, I was sitting here thinking, in the 13-year pause where South Carolina at first didn't have any executions and then couldn't find the lethal injection drug, there were all these efforts like firing squad and other things to be able to figure out how to restart them. But there never was any real effort to say, well, maybe we should just give everybody on death row clemency, life sentences, and just abolish the death penalty or no longer seek it in the state. So I think there says something that there wasn't any effort in the interim to just get rid of the death penalty.
We know that President Biden has not, under his presidency, has not executed anybody at the federal level. Donald Trump did. Where do we know where either of the candidates? We know where Donald Trump stands. Do we know where Vice President Harris stands on federal executions?
Gretchen. Well, in 2020, all of the people who were running for president as Democratic candidates, which would include Vice President Harris, were on record as opposing the death penalty. And that has really been a switch from the 90s when most Democrats certainly said publicly that they supported the death penalty.
Gretchen, I have 30 seconds left. There is no lobby, as we said, for people on death row, but do you see the political appetite for ending executions? Is there any evidence that's political appetite for that? 20 seconds.
Well, certainly the death penalty is dying a slow death. And the question is there political leadership that will say, why are we spending money on this? Why are we doing this? Let's just end it.
Gretchen Engels, capital defense attorney with the, and the executive director of the Center for Death Penalty Litigation. Jeffrey Collins reports for the Associated Press, the state of South Carolina. And Elizabeth Rennick is the staff writer for The Atlantic.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.